We present the news quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome again to the news quiz. We start with a cutting scene in the Eastern Daily Press TV listings, read by Harriet Cass.
8 p.m. Monkey Magic. Papa attempts one of the world's most dangerous tricks, the infamous bullet catch. Last in series.
Thanks to Chris Avery of Norwich for that. Let's meet the teams. Please welcome first on my right, John Sargent and newcomer Emma Kennedy. Opposite them on my left, oldcomers Alan Corran and Jeremy Hardy. John, who's having second thoughts about a second resolution?
Ah, this is a second resolution at the UN, which I think they're bound to get, and a third and a fourth if they want them. They're very good at passing resolutions at the UN. They just find it very difficult to do anything. But things are beginning to clear up anyway, because we now know that we are going to go to war. We are definitely going to go to war against the French. There have been hints all along that Iraq is the size of France. Get it? Like France. They're producing mustard gas, French mustard gas. The thing is that people always want to fight people they've fought before. So for us, it's the French and or the Germans. All we needed was a tall, arrogant Frenchman to say non, and then along came President Chirac.
I want to know if Blair is prepared to fight the war without US backing. Really. That would be a good wind-up in a press conference when he's answered all the questions about the moral reasons for the war, and then just say, Prime Minister, what do you think of Mr. Bush's assertion that he's lost interest in it and you're going to have to do it all on your own now?
But I find that the US at the moment is sort of like a mother whose daughter is about to get married and who's come to her and said, look, I know you've arranged this enormous reception and everything, but I don't want to get married anymore. And the mother going, oh, but it would be such a waste now. We've arranged it all.
To reassure us, the government has announced it's all right, they've got a bunker. So we're not to worry about the government, because that was the reason that we're against the war. We were worried about the government. They've got a special bunker somewhere that's bio-proof. And not only the government, but the city, thank God. Because the last thing you want in a biological warfare attack is that our frontline speculators and usurers be in danger. We want them working away, slashing the value of our pensions.
The US and Britain are once again at loggerheads with France, Germany and Russia when the trio warned they could veto a second resolution authorising war. Colin Powell cranked up the rhetoric when he accused Saddam of perpetuating lies, deceits and falsities. The Iraqi leader insisted he'd never worn falsities in his life, except once, well, maybe, but it was during Rag Week. Emma, who's been publicly bristling at Bristol's private policy?
Yes, this is the private schools have decided that they're going to boycott Bristol University because they are sort of disproportionately allowing people who come from state schools in order to go there. And the Headmasters and Headmistresses Conference saying that they will boycott Bristol University unless the admission procedures were fully documented, fair, objective, transparent, consistently applied, and returned immediately to being biased back towards the posh schools. But you can just imagine, can't you, sort of all the posh people from the posh schools walking down Whitehall, and what are they going to be shouting? We're eaten! We're eaten! But we are not beaten!
No, I think, Emma, you underestimate the skill of these people. They're going to have classes, I should have thought, at Eton to teach them how not to talk proper. The rhine in spine falls mine, the on, the pline. By golly, he's got it.
Bristol must be devastated that they're going to be deprived of so many fat-assed boys in corduroys called Ollie. Who are prepared to drink their own sick to impress girls. Whatever will the rugby club do?
Charles Clarke has said he considers it his role to ease the path of poorer students into better universities. This contrasts with John Prescott, who says his role is the cheese and ham with extra mayo. Jeremy, who's been accused of taking a laissez-faire attitude to work?
Don't know. yeah, it's the Japanese, Alan says. The Japanese say...
It's a bloke from Toyota.
It's a bloke from Toyota. I'm getting voices.
I think it is. a Japanese bloke who says that the... you look at me like that. I'm not going to make any jokes about this slant at all. he's a Japanese man who runs Toyota, and he says that the British don't work as hard as the French. He's watched the British put a wooden bridge over a river, and they were bloody slow at it. No, he's a Japanese who just thinks that we're not good enough to make his cars.
But I think you also accuse the British workers of being picky, which is quite wrong. I mean, there are things we're prepared to do, things we're not prepared to do, and we're not prepared to be pushed around by foreigners.
Toyota boss Kosuke Shiramitsu has claimed the company's British workers are lazier than their French counterparts. One British Toyota worker claimed that he did 10 hours overtime every week. Admittedly, as a minicab driver, but it's the thought that counts. Alan, your piece of music.
Shame! Shame! Everybody say it. Shame! Early in the morning. Late in the evening.
It's about a shake.
It is about a shake. Or
it's about that
called
shake.
That shake.
Mm. I've got to walk home alone after this programme. Well, apparently a friend of Osama bin Laden blew the whistle on this bloke. Sheikh Mohammed, is it? I mean, it's just a beard and a couple of eyes like all the others in the paper. But I'm sorry, I mean, it's not... I mean, it's art. I think it's a very clever disguise. It could be anybody. Most of them look like either Andy Hamilton or Salman Rushdie or in fact, Alan Yentob. You wouldn't know him, but he looks remarkably like Salman Rushdie. He was a bigwig in the BBC, and a year ago I was at a Christmas party in Broadcasting House, and there was Rushdie, and he was actually talking to Yentob, and they looked remarkably like one another. And Alan Bennett said, yes, but more people want to kill Alan Yentob. Which I
this wouldn't be the FBI that say that this is a top Al-Qaeda bloke with it. It's actually an elderly lady from Rill.
Fake bomb, you
know.
But they said, didn't they, that they found a treasure trove of evidence, which I don't know if this was included in that treasure trove, but there have been lots of photographs of what Osama bin Laden looks like now, and it looks like it's Des Lynam.
They keep arresting people who are vaguely North African and then having to let them go again. But in the flurry of publicity when they arrest somebody, they say they found replica weapons and a map of London. You think, you mean you found Cluedo and Monopoly, that's all.
According to the CIA, the captured Al-Qaeda boss enjoyed the trappings of Western life. Living in the Philippines, they claim he romped with erotic dancers in luxury hotels shortly before hosting a satirical news quiz on the TV. We start round two with a cutting sent in by Roy Jenkinson.
Notice seen on the wall at Warwick Castle torture chamber. Unsuitable for wheelchair users.
John, why is it all over and out for England?
Oh, this is a... I'm very bad on cricket stories, but I do know this is a cricket story. I just find it fantastically tedious. There was a moment of interest when we wanted to know where they would play in Zimbabwe. But they treated that like cricket too, didn't they? We thought they were going to decide, thought it would be resolved, and then the light was bad or something and left it for another day. And it went on for days and days. By the time they had decided where they were going to play in Zimbabwe, I'd lost all interest.
This week England were eliminated from the Cricket World Cup, taking place in Southern Africa. England's hopes of getting through to the second stage rested on Pakistan beating Zimbabwe, provided they won by a net run rate of below 0.5, assuming, that is, they batted first and failed to dismiss Zimbabwe within 13.2 overs. Or if Zimbabwe made at least 100 and Pakistan failed to achieve their targets in 10.5 overs. And some people say cricket's boring. Emma, listen to this.
I'm not a bat or a rat or a cat.
Yes, this is about moles.
Well done.
Kel Surprise. The mole population is getting out of hand, apparently, in England, because during the foot and mouth crisis, mole hunters weren't able to go out and kill the moles, so now their numbers have gone up. And sadly, we've run out of strychnine to deal with them. But apparently they're popping up everywhere, and they're a real menace, apparently, to racehorses that trip over them. This is true. This is true. I'm not making this up. And I know it's wrong of me, but I'd really like to see that happen. And also, apparently, it's not just racehorses, it's cattle. But when have you ever seen a cow running?
I've seen a cow run. They do that sort of feeble kind of half... You know, like when you hold the door open for somebody and they're a bit far away.
Yeah.
So they run in that feeble way to show willing. That's how cows run. And then a plucky mole hurls itself under their foot.
What I don't understand, though, is why moles have to be poisoned with strychnine. I mean, are they characters in an Agatha Christie novel?
Because these are Al-Qaeda moles.
Yeah.
This is the whole point.
Which you can kill them with mothballs, apparently, moles, but I don't know how that works.
You have to get them into your cardi drawer before. You have to coax them. Coax them with false promises.
I thought you just put your hands very firmly round their little throats and squeezed.
I don't know. I've never.
No, that's to make trousers.
No.
But while mole numbers are down, vole numbers are. No, hang on. No,
yeah,
mole
no,
numbers
voles are
up.
Are going down, and moles are going
down.
Up, like stalactites and stalagmites.
Yeah. It's very
My first is in vole, but not in shrew.
The problems with moles and voles is that they've never seen eye to eye, mostly because. Moles are blind, but other than that, moles are blind.
That's why they've got little dogs running around in front of them.
Farmers anxious to find an alternative poison to deal with the moles, and are advised to spread copies of the Daily Mail. Jeremy, why is McDonald's not as thick as it thinks it is?
People have noticed that things in adverts don't look exactly the same as the real thing. Like, just because people use Revlon or Clairol doesn't mean they're really attractive. And McDonald's new steak sandwich, or whatever it is, Chinese style liver and banana tortilla wrap, isn't representative. And what McDonald's said is, no, we just move all the toppings to the edge so you can see them. So it's not literally true, but it's like a sort of drama documentary. It's pointing at a higher truth. It's saying, here are all the things that are in the burger, but we're arranging them around the edge, you see. And inside there is just this ghastly, bleak void. Same as when you go into McDonald's. So that's what it is.
Apparently, Bill Clinton, when he went to the McDonald's in Blackpool last autumn with Kevin Spacey, he ordered one of these things called a Premier, whatever it is, and Alistair Campbell was there, and 200 people flooded into this tiny place. And Alistair thought, gosh, if only we get pictures of this. And he saw a little old man with a video. He rushed over to him and he said, that video could be worth a lot of money, you know, and be very useful. And the bloke said, yes, I know, but it's mine.
The ITC has banned adverts for McDonald's steak Premier sandwich after complaints that the burger in the advert was thicker and better filled than the reality. The thin and weedy burger was described as steak and ciabatta with char-grilled peppers, onions and black pepper mayo. And I'd like to add that I'm 6'4" tall, with rippling muscles, piercing cold eyes, granite jaw, and I'm the envy of donkeys everywhere. Alan, who's been paying lip service to sexual attraction?
Yeah.
Well, it's a university. I think it's in Louisville. It's the University of Kentucky in Louisville. They've been doing research into lips for 10 years, and they've discovered that lips are the most sensuous organ there is, second only to genitalia. You put the two together, and boy. And men are attracted to women primarily by their lips, and the fatter the lip, the better.
Unless you're Leslie Ash.
There's something about Leslie Ash. Why, has Leslie Ash done something with her face?
Yes, she has.
Well, I mean, she's done a lot with her face, I know.
We shouldn't really laugh, but, oh, all right, you've twisted my arm. she had collagen implants put into her lips, which basically made them sort of swell beyond recognition, so that now she looks like a tweenie. And she is apparently mortified and embarrassed and is waiting for them to go down.
Well, I just think it's very important.
She's waiting for them to go down?
Yes.
Sorry, on whom?
Of sharp satire for us. Keep us going.
University of Louisville psychologist Professor Michael Cunningham claims the size of someone's lips plays a key role in determining if they're sexually attractive to the opposite sex. Apparently men are looking for raven-haired, pouting beauties. Though what they do when Michael Portillo is out is anyone's guess.
Before he's we start... got lovely lips, hasn't he? Lovely salve lips. You can tell those lips have seen a chapstick on many occasions, can't you?
Before we start the final round, here's an item from Norwich's Eastern Evening News.
Assistance needed to measure and fit furniture covers and curtains to cover North Norfolk.
Thanks to Stephen Roberts for that. John, listen to this.
Toss them high, toss them high, toss them to the ceiling. Toss them high, catch them as they fall. On the table, pop them, don't you dare to drop them. Tuesday day is pancake day, let's dance our cares away.
Who's won the toss, John, when it comes to flipping a tricky problem?
This is all about Shrove Tuesday pancakes and some mathematical idiots who worked out exactly what the formula is for a perfect pancake. So this works out the trajectory, how big the thing is, how high it goes up. The only thing is that you have to take these measurements while you're throwing it in the air. So we're on radio, so I'm now going to throw the pancake into the air. Plonk, perfect. So that's how you do it. Do you want to do that bit again, or is it? Did you miss it?
John, are you missing work? Maybe you should do a course or something. Keep your mind occupied.
This is quite like a story that was around last year, where there was a scientific team at one of the universities, I think it was Leeds, who'd been given funding to investigate how to make a perfect cup of tea. And you just think, surely you've got more to do with your time.
No, I think I could do that. I'll just do it now. There we are, a perfect cup of tea.
You should work on the sound effects a bit there, John.
Then you have to do horses' hooves, don't you? Clop,
yes.
Clop, clop, clop.
And cobs.
No, you have to have coconut halves, don't you, to
yes.
do the clop, clop.
Yes.
Well, I haven't got them. I didn't know I was going to be asked to do horses' hooves. Hello. That's when you're going into a dungeon.
Oh,
we've been waiting for you.
And then, Simon!
And then, Simon, let me do the door
eve
creaking
of war.
Open.
Young men are punting down the cam. I don't want my last minutes to be here listening to John's reflections for the next 14 hours. We're dying.
I can
think
of
worse. I was going to do a door creaking open, but I won't now. That's it. Okay? That's it. I'm packing it up now. I've done my best. All right.
Physics students at Leeds University, working with the Asda supermarket chain, claim to have discovered the perfect formula for tossing a pancake. The formula is W equals the square root of pi times g over 4r, where W is the angular velocity of the pancake, g represents gravity, and r is, and I quote from the report precisely here, the distance between the centre of the pancake and the tosser's elbow. Emma, I'm going to text you your next question.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hang on. I've got my phone on vibrate. Oh. Oh, quick, send me another. Now, let me have a look.
Well, that's a good one.
Right.
It's the
it
only
says...
thing where men look at their mobile phones and say, look, mine's smaller than yours.
Well, this text message that you sent me, Simon, says, why are SAs... no longer great. And the answer is that basically somebody, a schoolgirl, sent in her homework, I think, this week, and it was written entirely in language used in text messaging. But I was wondering whether that this is something that that schools should embrace. And maybe they should set the essay questions differently, so it would be something like mukbuth, colon, dash right bracket, or colon, dash left bracket. Discus.
Do you notice all the way all these educational experts and the psychologists got very worked up about it? It's appalling. Threat to the language. I was rather on her side. I thought she was obviously good fun. Secret.
She'd been offered the fellowship by Bristol, you know.
A 13-year-old Scottish girl handed in an essay about her summer holidays written in text message shorthand. Her teacher did say it was a marked improvement, as normally the girl just sends in a text icon of a dog eating her homework. Jeremy, why was an hospital patient not happy with her treatment, cock?
I should warn you, Simon, that you just went into a really bad northern accent. Which wouldn't be such a bad thing, but you're from Yorkshire and you ought to be able to do better than that. I've no idea. I don't know anything tonight.
I think I know. This was a lady went into A&E with severe back pain and wanted a glass of water. And the sister on charge, who was from Lancashire, said, "Come on, cock, follow me." And the lady took great umbrage at the fact that the nurse had used the word cock in the phrase, even though I understand the patient came from Lancashire herself, so basically she didn't like that. But what I like about this story is that somebody, even in the throes of sort of terrible, terrible discomfort, puts an emphasis on social formalities. I think that's absolutely correct.
I think that's very admirable.
I think it's absolutely
very firm about these things. Mr. Sergeant, not John to you.
Yeah. Because sir. I like, yes, well, I always call you sir in our private moments.
Exactly. But I think what we've got to remember about this case, and in fact, it was a panic attack she'd had. Then she was called cock. She had another panic attack. And presumably, the sister it was, she'd probably been told to tell 100 patients that they were a cock that day.
Reduce the waiting list.
Although it was inappropriate, she had to go ahead, otherwise the hospital would have lost millions of pounds.
And Mrs. Wilkin Wyke of Oswald Twistle, Lancashire, has made an official complaint to her local hospital, objecting to being called cock by a nurse. All hospital staff have since been warned about using potentially offensive language, such as duck, mate, I'm not touching that, and have you thought about joining Booper? Alan, who made the police look like a bunch of Charlies when they nicked a Dali?
Yeah, it's Rikers Island, which is a prison in New York. And Salvador Dali was going there in the 1960s to give some kind of lecture or eat a hedgehog or those remarkable things that Dali would do in front of audiences. And he wasn't very well, and he couldn't go, so he sent a picture instead of the crucified Christ. And amazingly, the prisoner showed great restraint for 40 years, and finally they couldn't stand it any longer, and they nicked it. And it's gone, and the police think it's an inside job.
I don't think it was a great example of Dali's work, though. I mean, I gather that, first of all, it went to the canteen in this prison, but they pelted it with food, and they then moved it to another position. And then, when they realised it had gone, they only spotted it had gone because it looked more surreal than it usually did.
How did they get it out? Did they sort of go and make a cake shaped like a melting clock or something in the kitchen and give it to one of their visiting relatives? Or, oh, what's that in your mouth? Oh, it's just a Dali painting here, come and kiss me. How did they get it out?
They hid it in a cave and after 3 days it was just gone.
As well as paintings, Dali tried to write movie screenplays, including one called The Prodigious Story of the Lacemaker and the Rhinoceros. And surprisingly, there's never been a prodigious story of the Lacemaker and the Rhinoceros 2. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along. John.
Well, this is from Les Marshall from Woodbridge, who Suffolk, who sent this in. It's actually a sort of little poster for Age Concern, It has a picture of Gordon Lishman, OBE, on it, who's Director General of Age Concern, and he says, Age Concern is always seeking to work in the best interests of older people. We've also worked very hard to make our funeral plan excellent value for money.
Emma.
Mine is sent in from George Owen, and it's from a TV listings magazine. And it reads, 10:55, film, Black Sea 213, 1998. A photographer falls foul of a sadistic weapons trader, but help is on hand in the shapely forms of the world's sexiest mercenary group. Erotic drama with Timothy Bottoms.
Jeremy.
This is sent in by Georgie Strout from Cornwall, and it's from the Cornish Guardian. A woman who claimed that the Beast of Bodmin Moor was laying siege to her house has made the list of the top 10 funniest calls to the RSPCA. The woman phoned to report that she was trapped indoors because a black cat-like creature had been crouching on her doorstep for 24 hours. She thought it might be the infamous Beast of Bodmin Moor, but the skulking beast turned out to be a deliverer of phone directories in a black plastic bag.
This is from a report in the Evening Standard, Simon, of the one of the big anti-war demonstrations. It says John, not his real name, insisted, in order to conceal his identity during the interview, on wearing his George Bush mask. It was thus almost impossible to understand a word he was saying.
Thank you all. Let's look at the final score. Jeremy and Alan have 14, but John and Emma have a dazzling 18 points. And before we leave you, here's a headline from the Wisconsin Tribune.
Police body cavity search reveals crack.
With that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were John Sargent, Emma Kennedy, Jeremy Hardy and Alan Corrin. The chairman was Simon Hoggart and the news was read by me, Harriet Cass. The chairman's script was written by George Poles, Paul McKenzie, Lucy Clark and Dave Cohen. And the producer was Simon Nichols.
My cab driver tonight told me a very good story about bees. There were these two blokes sitting in a pub who just retired. And one was saying we ought to get hobbies. And the second one said, I actually do have a hobby. I keep bees. And his friend said, well, that's really very interesting. We've got hives and everything. He said, no. He said, I keep them in a jar. Do you give them in a jar? You mean you pick? Yeah, I pick them up and I put them in a jar. He said, well, I hope you look after them. Do you give them grass? Yeah, I give them grass and pollen and flowers and tremendous nourishment. And he said, how do you keep them in? Well, I've got this paper around the top with a rubber band. So his friend said, well, I hope you use a needle to prick it in for air. He said, no, I don't. Then I said, but they'll die. His friend said, it's only a hobby.